I'd like to call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs to order. It is now 8:02 a.m. Thursday, March 14th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Kopp, Representative Lincoln, Vice Chair Edgman, Representative Ortiz, and Representative Vance, and myself, Representative Zilkuski, Chair. Brief at ease. We are back on record. Before we begin, let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you in advance. I'd like to thank Tribal Affairs Committee aide Grace Singh, Julia Bushman from the Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. We will begin today's hearing on other Alaska Native entities with a presentation from Anthony Gunnock-Malott, President and CEO of Sea Alaska. He also joins us today in his role as a member of the ANCSA Regional CEO Association. Mr. Malott, please come forward, state your name for the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Again, I'm Anthony Malott, President and CEO at Sea Alaska. Born and raised in Yakutat, went to high school in Juneau, and glad to be working here in Juneau. Thank you all for meeting with many of us last week. We'll be continuing to come back and value all the important work that you are doing here. Obviously, I'm not Kim Reitmeier. She is the executive director of the ANCSA Regional Association. As I get through here, I'll describe the differences between the independent regional corporations and the organization, which is ARA, and why we exist and the work we do in a coordinated fashion. I think we all understand the history of land claims. If there's any specific questions about the timeline, you know, I believe you'll have some questions at the end, but this is just more informational. What I would add from Southeast Alaska is that the A&B and A&S was formed in the early 1900s. We believe that was a very important step. They actually sent lawyers back to D.C. They filed land claims. So land claims from the Native side has been fought from the late 1800s, formed through the A&B, A&S. They achieved the creation of Tlingit and Haida, the tribe in Southeast Alaska, and then Tlingit and Haida itself continued to fight for land claims. And the culmination was 1971, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
Mr. Malott,
yes.
For those who might be listening and maybe members of our committee that are unfamiliar with A&B and A&S, can you just define what that is for us?
A&B, A&S is the Alaska Native Brotherhood was formed first. It was a grassroots organization. I believe the A&B was formed in Sitka, and the A&S was formed in Wrangell, and they were member organizations, and they contained members from all of our traditional communities.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. So 1971, with the passage of ANCSA, the time period was predicated based on the fact of the discovery of oil. The formation was very quick. Worked very fast to transfer 44 million acres of land to the 12 regional corporations, and I believe the correct number of village corps is closer to 250, plus close to $1 billion that represented dollars paid for the land that wasn't fully represented or able to be transferred to Native ownership. The 13th regional is for those shareholders at that point in time that lived outside of the state and may have wanted to be represented as outside of the state. Natives, they did not get land. So right now the 13th regional is landless. They do have some operations, but they are much less active than the 12 regionals by many degrees. I think as you found with presentations prior and the presentations throughout the day, there are many layers of Native organizations. This gets very confusing even for our shareholders or our tribal citizens, especially as you move outside of the region. If you live in the region, you can recognize who Tlingit and Haida is. You can recognize who Gold Belt is, who Sea Alaska is, who the Housing Authority is, who Douglas Indian Association is. That's just southeast. So the layers are deep. We work together the best that we can. We represent a common constituency. We represent common communities. And that's the lead in all the work that we do together. The one thing that makes it additionally confusing is that these layers are different region by region. So it's not, you know, as laid out like that. Siri is very different. Nana, all of their village corps are part of Nana. In the Sea Alaska region, we have 13 distinct village corps that are their own entity and their own corporation. They represent their communities well, and they have land around their community. I believe Otna is another regional corporation that has combined their village corps within the regional corporation. But won't get into much more detail here because you do have additional panelists that will coming up and talking to you about their functions. I would just like to represent that we aim to work together, and we're getting better at working together. The regional corporations by region, just really quickly, this was effectively by just common culture. The maps were drawn by common culture and common interests. The shareholder base in 1971 represented shareholders that were originally from these regions or lived in these regions at this point in time. For example, Sea Alaska has many Aleut shareholders that were here living in Southeast at the time of the passage of ANCSA. There was a quarter blood quantum required, a BIA certified quarter blood quantum. That is an issue as we move forward. The one thing I mentioned, the common constituency that we have with our tribal citizens, that starts getting differentiated as the ANCs continue to abide by the original quarter blood quantum, and some of our tribes have lineal descendancy. It's an issue that we have to address at some point in time, and it is a very serious one to us. We like the fact that we have common constituency with our tribal citizens and prioritize not leaving out those that would feel it's their right as Native Alaskans.
Representative Ortiz has a question.
Thank you, Anthony, for being here with us this morning, and thank you, Madam Chair. So how, and again, it's difficult, as you say, to understand some of the differences here. What would be the difference between, in my region, Cape Fox Corporation from some of these different Alaska Native regional corporations?
So Cape Fox is a village corp that represents Saxman.
Okay.
Ketchikan is a landless community. Ketchikan shareholders are Sea Alaska shareholders.
Okay.
But they also were registered as Ketchikan landless. And if their landless effort through Congress right now is able to get passed, they would become Ketchikan Urban Corp shareholders. So it was by distinct community, which is why you get the total of 256 village corps. The two slight differences, Gold Belt is considered an urban corp. I believe they were just added later. There's some kind of things, like I said, it happened so quickly. 1971 passed, and then all these events piled on, and one of the latter efforts was to get some of the urban corps, Gold Belt, Sciatica, and there's a few up north. And there's a slight technical differences between an urban corp and a village corp that I'll get to when I hit 7I and 7J.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Please continue.
So just really quickly on the association, all 12 regionals, the Village Corps in our region, we consider them all sister corporations. We prioritize working together. We know we have common cause. That common cause typically sticks to policy efforts, working on things that we all care about very deeply, subsistence, the health of our communities, the resiliency of our communities, economic development. Those things keep us working together, and the organization assures that, we don't forget that, and we continually meet. Have the faces and the names here. We had a group of us come down and visit with many of you, as I said, a week or so ago. Another group's coming in another week, and we'll continue. I think you'll see all of these faces down here throughout your session. I highlight the table of numbers, not to get into the detail because you can't see them, but just when we get to the few charts that I have, the numbers in the tables and the charts that I have follow from these tables. And it really highlights a couple of things. There's a huge difference between revenue and net income. I think most people know that, but it really gets confusing when everybody talks about the top 49ers. When everybody sees the billions that Alaska Native corporations have, those billions are revenue, which is very, very different from net income. And I'll walk through the difference between close to $9 billion in revenue and net income of closer to this five-year average, about $250 million. Across the 12 regional corporations, $250 million in net income. And then what do the regional corps do with those $250 million in net income? Because that's what you can do something with. That's the excess cash, the excess income you have from the billions in revenues. I skipped over quickly the difference between land claims. Up to that point in time, Native land claims were settled through trust land, reservation land. ANCSA was specifically tailored to avoid reservation land in Alaska, trust land in Alaska. And we own our land fee simple. We are for-profit corporations. But as we go through the presentation, we act more like a family office. Every dollar we ever make will benefit and go back to our shareholders, which are the original Alaska Natives that we represent.
Mr. Malott, can you speak to the history of why Alaska settled land claims through fee simple lands and not land into trust, as in other reservations around the country?
I think there's many theories. Native community claims assimilation, but there's difficulty, as you could imagine, having 256 reservation systems all across Alaska. So there, I think there was a whole combination of reasons at that point in time that led to this. I think there was general agreement on both sides that this was a settlement that worked for us.
Thank you.
It is one that we continue almost 50 years later to have to explain, especially when we travel outside of the state. We represent tribal citizens, but they are shareholders, and the land that we represent, their original indigenous claimed rights, the land that they've lived on for 10,000 years, is not held in trust. It's held within the corporations. We treat it as dearly as anywhere else. We don't carry the land on our balance sheet. We have land protections, and then we also, in majority, have land policies within our own corporations that continue to cement the fact that we will prioritize never losing an acre of land.
Before you move on to the next slide, can you talk a little bit about the bullet point that not all Alaska Native people are shareholders within INCSA corporations?
I think that goes back to the blood quantum. In bulk, that would be the main differentiation. If Clinkett and Haida already talked with you, I believe they have upwards of 30,000 tribal citizens. We have 22,000 shareholders. Some of the differentiation is as we've designed our descendancy system, you get your shares at 18. So a lot of the different 8,000 difference between Clinkett and Haida's roles and Sea Alaska's could be that under 18, but then the rest of it is the quarter blood quantum issue.
Thank you.
So we all know the federal land ownership of the state. We in Southeast understand it very deeply. 96% of Southeast is federally owned. So we find ourselves in a unique situation compared to this statewide representation of land ownership. At the time of the passage of ANCSA, with the Tongass National Forest, with Glacier Bay National Park, with Misty Bay Fjords, with all of those in existence, Sea Alaska was 21% of the original over 100,000 shareholders. And we received less than 1% of the 44 million acres. So of the 44 million acres, Sea Alaska received 360,000 acres. And it was because of the federal land ownership in Southeast Alaska that constricted us so inordinately compared to, let's say, Doyon that got 11 million acres. So there's a big difference based on where this federal land ownership map kind of lied. So it's why in Southeast every single one of those 360,000 acres is very dear to us. And even so, to get to that level, I know the people that fought for that, we were being pushed to accept much less, and they fought for even that amount. And it's very, without the Native Corps, there'd only be less than 1% of private land ownership in Southeast, and you see the same. It's very similar in the state. So there's certain differences. Even though we are a for-profit corporation, it's really structured legally and through statute that it is more of a family office, even though we can't kick people out. stock cannot be traded or sold. We have some shareholders that value that deeply and some that could, leave it. We value it. Our common constituency is what drives us day to day, the fact that we're benefiting them, that we're working for them, that we are protecting their land. We have those conversations every day. So the unique differences between any other for-profit corporation and an Alaska Native Corp are real and significant. And some of it is very positive, as in terms of keeping our common constituency, and some of it makes it very difficult to perform as a regular corporation as well. And we've, through 50 years now, worked out those differences and made sure we have mitigating factors to be able to overcome some of these issues. One of the most unique and many layers to the 7I and 7J conversation, but it is a fantastic part of ANCSA. I think every regional corporation would say it's a fantastic part of ANCSA. I believe every village corp would say it's a fantastic part of ANCSA, even those payers. Sea Alaska was an early payer with our timber harvest. All subsurface resources and timber are 7I and 7J resources. And 7I says that 70% of the profit that you make is shared throughout the entire system. So if we cut a tree and make a dollar, 70 cents of that dollar is shared throughout the state. As ASRC develops oil and they get a dollar, 70 cents of that goes to all of the other regionals and then is distributed through 7J to the village corps. So you can imagine early on with the startup of these corporations, the fact that Sea Alaska, SERI, and ASRC at those early days were sharing natural gas wealth, some oil exploration wealth, some timber wealth. We were propping the system up with that sharing. And now with ASRC, with NANA, with a handful of others, they are continuing to prop up the system, especially at the Village Corp level. And in my mind, the main value of this sharing is that it really provides a buffer to avoid bankruptcy. One of the scariest parts of being a for-profit corporation is bankruptcy and potentially losing your land or being forced to sell your land. The fact that this 7I7J system is sharing wealth across all of the village corps and the regional corporations, it means that there is a significant buffer that they have to avoid being in a situation that they would be forced to sell their land. And at this point in time, there has been very, very few acres that have left Native Corporation hands from the original 44 million. In drastic difference to those ANCs that transferred some of those lands to their shareholders or Native allotments. Native allotments move out of Native hands fairly frequently, and original allotments that were provided to shareholders fairly quickly moved out of Native ownership as well. So the 7I and 7J is a big part of keeping Native lands within the system. I already mentioned the fact that undeveloped land is not carried on our balance sheet. The banks know this. They understand that they cannot put a lien or collateralize our land base. They can collateralize if we would like some of our resources, but even that is lightly used, just because, again, the land is everything, the original reason why we're in existence. As I move to how ANCSA corporations have diversified our economy, we look at the billions in revenues that kind of keep us all within the top 49ers. Again, that is something that we're working to avoid. The thought that because we have billions, which is not true, but just because someone sees that the top 40 of the 49ers are all Alaska Native corporations, and you see billions, 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 that we have those billions, again, that is revenue. That is the gross revenue that our corporations throughout the nation receive. What flows through after salaries and cost of goods and G&A and marketing and all of that is net income, which again is closer to the 250 million level. So we work hard to value what revenue describes. Revenue describes an economic impact. It describes jobs. It describes what we put into the economy. But what we get on the back end is very different. So it is a positive number for the state, not only the natural resource development that we do, but the service companies that many of us own. And when we get to the jobs numbers, you see that we're a big part of the description of the top, effectively, let's say, top 50 companies in Alaska. The ANCs are dominant within that, not only on the revenue side, but in the job side as well. As I quickly move on, what do we do with that money is a question that we see a lot. This table, and I will try to get through it quickly, describes that effectively 100% of that $250 million in net income that I'm talking about goes to our shareholders in dividends, in donations to cultural and Native nonprofits, and to donations to non-Native nonprofits. That is the bulk. And you see that that both of those lines surround 100%. So I always like to say every dollar we ever make goes back to our shareholder base. This confirms that. And you see $250 million goes pretty quickly. On average, $170 million in dividends that we provide on an annual basis, that's just barely over $1,000 per shareholder. So on a per cap, it is not that significant. It's important to our shareholders to receive that money. It helps, especially in the rural community, but it is not, as we say, life-changing money. And that's the priority of our shareholders, but culture, maintaining culture, arts, language is another priority, and education is a priority, so scholarships is a big part. So the bulk of the $250 million that the ANCs make quickly go out in dividends, culture, and scholarships, and education focus to our shareholders, because that is what our shareholders prioritize. I think this is, I've represented a lot of this already, and would just ask if you have any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee, Representative Ortiz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the chart in the brown section of the thing, donations to Native nonprofit efforts. Can you give me some examples of some organizations that I might recognize in terms of those nonprofits that role to play?
AWARE in Southeast, HOPE organization on Prince of Wales. You know, they are typically did you say Native nonprofits?
Well, yeah, the Native nonprofit effort.
Okay, sorry. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, Alaska Native Heritage Center. You know, each region has their own nonprofits, even the Village Corps. So there's a Huna Heritage, Gold Belt has a Gold Belt Heritage. So typically it is a close affiliated nonprofit that works, again, on the cultural enhancement of their tribe or region. For example, Sea Alaska gives $1.7 million annually to Sea Alaska Heritage Institute.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Awesome. Representative Edgman.
Good morning, Anthony. Good morning. Thank you. Thank you for being here. So maybe throw you a bit of a softball, but we hear occasionally, maybe less today than we did a few years ago, that, the regional corp should just pay for it. And we're in an era where we are, you know, facing severe budget reductions, and I think there's some sense by, you know, maybe a few at least, I hope, that the regional corps or maybe other Native entities can just sort of pick up the tab, but maybe give you the opportunity to speak why that's not the mission of the regional corporations.
But not only the mission, but even the capacity to do that, because I think some of that comes from the fact that they hear billions and they think we have those billions to put to work. You know, we utilize these slides purposefully to say that the dollars that we make are very well utilized right now, and there's not excess at this point in time. But you're right, the entire system is meant to take over, is to cover many of those social and community and socioeconomic and governance issues and programs for our people. So the tribes is another entity that has funding for specific programmatic purposes that match up more closely to the government. And when they fall short in their funding, we actually work closely to prioritize, you know, working with them in areas that our shareholders or tribal citizens are not being served. But again, Alaska Native corporations with the land base were charged with the economic side, economic development, jobs, dividends, with the tribes taking a lot of the social purview of oversight of our shareholder tribal citizen base.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Malott.
Thank you.
Oh. Sorry, Representative Kopp, did you have a question?
No, I was just going to say thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes. Gunasheesh, for your time today. We will now hear from Hallie Bissett, a CIRI board member and the executive director of the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association, or ANVCA. Ms. Bissett, please come forward, state your name for the record, and begin your presentation.
Good morning. My name is Hallie Bissett. I am the executive director for the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. I'm also the great-granddaughter of Chief Nick Nikolai, who was the last traditional chief of Talkeetna area, or Sunshine Village. Here today, thank you for inviting us, Chair Zolkowski, to this committee to tell you about village corporations. I do have a little bit of an overview of ANCSA, which we can probably skip through because Anthony did such a stellar job there. I'll add a few details, and if you have questions, please go ahead and ask. About us, though, we were created in 2008 by a founding member of the Kuskokwim Corporation. The president and CEO there, Maver Carey, had the vision to really understand that the village corporations would need its own association, separate and apart from the regional association you just heard from, because we are a little bit different. We're a little bit different of an organization as well. We're a 501c6. We have both member, dues-paying member organizations, which are our village corporations. And we also have partner organizations that fund our organization. And our partners are usually private for-profit businesses that promote the development of Alaska Native Village Corporations, but we do have many nonprofit partners as well, such as the Small Business Association and agencies like that. We have a 9-member board of directors. I've put them up here. I'm not going to name all of their names, but just to give you an idea of the cross-section of regions and villages that are represented by our board of directors. These 9-member board of directors are elected at our annual meeting every year by the full 177 villages that we represent to serve on their behalf. Again, the high-level overview, 44 million acres of land. It's between 9.7 and 11.7%, depending on which acreage number you're using, so that's why there's a little bit of a difference between what I've said here and what Anthony reported in the 12% total. 962 million, what people don't know about that was split 12 ways, and it was paid out actually over about 11 years. So it wasn't like this big chunk of money that we got all at once. And time value of money kind of ate away at the total over those 11 years that it was paid out. It did create 12 in-state regional corporations and one 13th region created later for those that were living outside. And there were over 256 village corporations, and these are entities that did have 25 or more Native people living in the area. That's what would qualify for a village corporation. You had to have 25 or more Alaska Native people living in the area to get registered as a village corporation. An urban corporation is not the same as a village corporation. There are 4 urban corporations that I also include in that 256 number. I also include it when I say we represent 177 because we include the urban corporations and the advocacy work that we do. They include Gold Belt, Sheattica, Natives of Kodiak, and Kenai Natives Association. And as Anthony alluded to, there is an effort underway to get a few more, I think 5, maybe 6 more of these urban corporations that would be created if we were successful in amending ANCSA to get the land lost villages their land they should have gotten. One of the things I also wanted to mention in terms of why Native people are not all shareholders. There was a cutoff date, December 18th, 1971. If you were not born on or before December 18th, 1971, if you were born on December 19th, 1971, you did not receive shares in a Native corporation. Now, I'll get later to some of the regional corporations and even village corporations have chosen to include those born after that date, but there was a strong cutoff date, December 18th, 1971, that said you were a shareholder or you are not. I serve on the board of directors for CIRI, which is a regional corporation. I was born after 1971, and the only reason I'm able to serve in the capacity on the board there is because my mother gifted me shares. So we are allowed to, while we're still alive, gift our family a number of shares if we would like. And I cover a little bit about that later on in the presentation, so I did want to make sure I mentioned the cutoff. Regional corporations typically have the subsurface estate rights, so all the mineral rights, anything that's under the ground, oil and these sorts of things. Village corporations will typically have the surface rights to the land, and that's a really big difference between the land type of ownership that we got. A key provision that Anthony covered is the 797J revenue sharing provision. It's very, very important to the villages. They're recapitalized every year through this system. I can tell you that some of our villages are almost completely dependent on those 7J payments that they get every year. Back at the napkin, I'd say about 80% would not exist without the infusion from 7J payments, mostly from NANA and ASRC at this point from the Red Dog Mine. It was 30% of some of even the regional corporations' net incomes. So they're very, very important to us.
Ms. Bissette, before you move on, can you provide us an example of regional corporations' subsurface rights and village corporations' surface estate rights in the context of how they might be utilized by the corporations?
Sure. A great example would be, you know, if Doyon had been successful in finding natural gas in Fairbanks, they would have been working with our village corporation, Togatili, on their surface estate lands to develop the processing facilities that would have been on the surface. That would have been like a land lease, for instance, and the subsurface and royalties and all of that, I'm sure, would have to be negotiated with the village, but that's all in concert with each other. The surface and the subsurface, in terms of development, we work very close together and make sure that both are benefiting from any type of resource development. Anthony's map was so much better than mine, so mine's kind of embarrassing. I don't even know if Jill is still right there, so let's just, you know, he covered that. just a little bit more about what we do. We promote the success of village corporations and the protection of our native lands. As Anthony alluded to, lands is very, very important to us. It's what we're tied to. It's what makes us Alaska Native people, and we want to protect our land ownership as much as possible. Our vision is to support our mission with projects and activities that provide education to village corporations, advocacy for village corporations, outreach and inclusion of village corporations statewide and really globally, and village corporation sustainability. We've got networking events we do, 12 events a year. This one that we're doing this month, next week, we're doing an update on the Donlin project, which would be a shareable resource revenue project if it were to go through. We alternate between business topics and important topics to our community, such as the Donlin project and what's going on there. Many of you met with us during our legislative fly-in in February. Thank you for your time then. We come here every year on our legislative fly-in. We have a membership and a lands committee that do work throughout the year on various topics. I would invite any of you that want to address any of our committees or board, please do. We're here to work with you and be part of solutions. And we have our annual conference and business meeting, which takes place May 8th and 9th this year. And that is really just a training event. It's for roundtables. It's for sharing best practices amongst ANCSA regional and village corporations. Where we advocate mainly is around land solutions. We want to protect minority-owned business programs, like the ones that you see in Department of Transportation, minority business enterprise requirements, things like that. Secure solution for Alaska's fiscal future is a term that we just use to make sure that that we do have a balanced state budget, but that is very important. It's not happening on the backs of rural Alaskans. We support economic and infrastructure development, and we develop policy around supporting those projects. And we promote the inclusion of Alaska Native representation in Arctic discussions and decisions, and that's on a global basis. And then something we do very effectively is get out the native vote, which is just a campaign we do every year when it during campaign season, regardless of who's in there. It's not about who you vote for, it's just about please get out there and vote. I'll talk about the economic impact. This is just the villages here that I'm showing. And this is, again, the top 49er list. And we'll remind you again, these are revenues, not net incomes in general that we're talking about. But I love updating this list every year because every year I get to add another village corporation. You'll notice if there's not numbered, but there are 11 listed there. And if they all had to report, there'd be more than that. We'd have more than 12. And so we're very proud of that. 20% of the total revenue in the top 49ers are coming from village corporations. We'll see Chenega and a Fognac and a UIC there in the top 10. And those are village corporations. Combined, the village corporations and the urban corporations generated about $3.7 billion in 2017. And when you add in the regional corporations, it jumps up to 12.9 really, if you include my, it gets a little confusing because I've got all my villages and then I'll have just their data from their report. So 12.9 billion is the total combined impact of the regional and the village corporations based on the data that I'm tracking, and that includes all the available public data from our villages and then what they were self-reported to us. The first bullet here is very important. Alaska Native Village Corporations and regional corporations really reverse the traditional Alaska economic model, whereby typically a company will come in and extract a resource, whether it be oil or natural gas or sea otter pellets, and they're taking those revenues home with them. Well, Alaska Native corporations, and very much so village corporations where there is no economy, have to go outside the state of Alaska, outside of their village, generate revenues and profits, and return those home. And I think that's a beautiful thing because it allows us to work together in public-private partnership types of ways to develop infrastructure that we may need to develop economies where they don't exist today. I've got some great examples I can give you if you'd like, but in the interest of time, we'll just kind of get through this whole thing. If you get the $12.9 billion, that's about a quarter of Alaska's GDP is Alaska Native Corporations. Do we count that? Well, I can tell you it just depends on which economist you talk to. but I can tell you that the number I like to really highlight, it is 100%. If you factor in all the data we have for all the Alaska Native corporations, but on average, 80% or more of every single Native corporation's net income is being returned to the community. And as a business person, the first time I heard that statistic, I was like, what are you doing? But it really highlights the commitment that these corporations have to their communities. They're returning it through scholarships, dividends, donations to both Native entities and non-Native charitable nonprofits like the Alaska Humanities Forum, United Way. I mean, we're involved in all those campaigns as well. So, jobs, Anthony covered that. So we can kind of, it comes right out of their report, which is beautiful. If you don't have a copy, you should get one. Other really interesting facts about ANCs, over half of the regional corporations and many of the village corporations have voted to include those born after 1971 as shareholders. Siri has not. Chelista just went through it. So they're including everybody that was born after December 18th, 1971 as new shareholders. And they've all done it very differently. Anthony alluded to the fact that, you know, there's class, I think, is it B or I can't remember, D stock that they get when they turn 18. There's other village corporations that you get it when you're born. It's different for every region, and it's a very personal decision, and it's a very huge campaign to get it done. Every region and most of the villages have an educational foundation that are providing scholarships and grants to their shareholders and their families. Most villages have individual foundations, as we've mentioned already. A majority of these entities are providing things to their shareholders that most corporations would never even dream of, like elder benefits, death and funeral expense assistance. Bering Straits just increased theirs to, I think, about $8,000 to assist in burial expenses when one of our shareholders passes, unfortunately. Some even do, I think ASRC has its own bank. They do microloans for some of our villages they work with to help do economic development in the villages. And then I don't need to say it again, but I went ahead and put it in there again. We reversed the traditional economic model for Alaska. And so again, we love to talk about how successful we are and how great that is, but really it's only some. So we've got a handful of village corporations that are doing really extraordinarily well. But I mentioned I represent 177 entities here today. For the 50 corporations that we have data for, we know they're generating returns. The 50 village corporations we know about are about the $3.4 billion. That excludes the urban corporation, if you're wondering the difference between 3.4 and 3.7. That's just 50 villages. So 120 so are not included in that number. They're really struggling. A lot of them have made investments at home and in the village where they may or may not have made sense. I think that I like to think of the villages as entrepreneurial people. And if you think about it, there's not a lot of 20-something unicorns out there that are amazing entrepreneurs and extremely well, astute at business, right? I think that you find more that entrepreneurs that are very successful are more in the late 40s to early 50s age range, and that's because they've gone out, they've learned, they've made mistakes, they've learned what to do and what works well and what doesn't work well. And so I believe when our human capital from all of this this investment that we've made through scholarships and internships and getting our people in corporate positions, I think that once the human capital really spreads out to all the other village corporations, you're really going to see a lot more growth here. And it's going to be an exciting story. So we help to encourage economic development and activity for these villages. I've got an advocacy piece here. This just really goes over kind of some of the items that we've advocated on before. I'm certainly not going to go through all of these. If you do have a question about one of these bullets, you're welcome to ask me. But one thing, while you're all here in front of me, I want to say thank you to every one of you, because last year we got SB 202 passed, which relieved Alaska Native Alaska Native Corporations of liability for contaminated lands that we had received as part of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. I can tell you we have a March 1st deadline that came up on brownfield development grants that we are now eligible for because of that work that was done here last year. And we do have village corporations that are actively involved in applying for those grants, and we will start seeing actual cleanup activity in the villages because of that legislation. So thank you for that. These are just some of the things we're still working on in terms of the contaminated land piece. If you have questions, like I said, I'm happy to answer those. These are contaminated lands. This is more of a federal thing, but there is a state ask. We want to make sure that the state is prioritizing Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act lands when cleanup is happening, because there's a limited amount of dollars out there in grants, but we really need to get these things cleaned up, 50 years after it passed, almost. So, federal contracting, we didn't talk a lot about. The 8A contracting program is extremely important to Alaska Native corporations, but I don't know if you'll recall, but it's in Anthony's presentation. It is not as big a chunk of our revenues as one would seem to assume. People seem to assume we make all of our money that way, and it's just not accurate. But it is important to our folks, that program, so we work very hard on protecting it. I've included some legislative advocacy items here that we're working on federally to ensure that Alaska has money for Indian energy projects in rural Alaska, spill response training type things. One that we're working pretty hard on right now is we want to ensure that Alaska Native corporations have investment opportunities if the Trump administration starts working on infrastructure legislation. We want to carve out opportunities for Alaska Native and other disadvantaged businesses to participate in public-private partnerships, not just the service contracts, but the actual investments, so that we have ongoing revenue forever. We're charged with offering dividends and perpetuity really for our shareholders to help sustain what we've created here. So those types of projects are very attractive to us.
you know, there's some telecommunications one in here just to give you an idea about how we work very closely with our partners to identify and understand what is actually going to be needed in the state of Alaska for infrastructure or the lack thereof. And we try to focus on ones that are going to impact statewide for our villages. There's a few telecommunications sites in here, and this is just giving you an idea of what we did on our last fly-in in D.C. And again, if you have questions on any of these bullets, I'm happy to answer or go into more detail on them. Each one of these keeps me talking for another 10 minutes. the state priorities is probably what you're most interested in. So I will go through this. I did already talk about prioritizing ANCSA-contaminated lands, supporting the return of 14C3 ANCSA lands from the state to village corporations to elect to not have a borough or municipality in their village. Let me spend just a little bit of time on this one, Madam Chair, if I have. I don't know what time we're doing here.
Please continue.
Okay. 14C3 was a provision of ANCSA that said every single village had to give back to the state of Alaska to be held in trust about 1,200 acres of pretty prime real estate in every single village, quite frankly. And about almost 50 years later, there's a system that we believe is in place that's working very well with the appropriate village entity to work with the duly elected entities that are out in these villages already. And some of these villages, like Chinega, for instance, are probably thinking to themselves, we're never going to have a borough or a municipality. So the ask here is that we would like a process for the state of Alaska, who has the power and the authority to currently transfer these lands back to our appropriate village entities, that they do so. We've been working with the state administration for several years now on one particular piece of property, just trying to get a community school back transferred to the Village of Corporation of Chinega is just one example. They want to use it for a community-based project, and they're having to go to the State Department of Commerce and hat in hand and asking for their lands back and having to prove that they know what's best for the land they've been living on for thousands of years. So what we ask here is standard operating procedure. What are the boxes we need to check? What are the things that the state would be uncomfortable with these types of transfers, and how do we work to a place where we can return these lands to the villages for community purposes? Number three there, amend the local boundary commission process to include requirements for consent from current landowners prior to forming a borough or a municipality. Well, that one actually has a story that comes with it. There was a recent effort by a woman that we understand to be an out-of-state landowner. She has a land that she owns in Girdwood, and her permits were denied for a development project she wanted to do in Girdwood, so she decided she would just create a new borough. And this new borough would include Girdwood, Whittier, Valdez, Chitna, Chinega, EX. So it caught our attention, and we really started reviewing the local boundary commission process, and there is nothing in there. There's no stopgate whatsoever for a landowner, such as a village or a regional corporation, to opt out or raise. I mean, there's appeals processes and what have you, but there's no, we believe there should be a step that says you need to get the explicit consent via board resolution from the existing landowner prior to formation of a borough, or at least it should be part of the process. And if you don't get it, we would like to have an opportunity to opt our lands out of any proposed new borough. That's what that one is. Number four is a simple ask, especially in this environment. Education is very, very important to us. As for-profit corporations under the state of Alaska, we're actually not allowed to give money specifically to our communities. We live under the same corporate rules as every other corporation, unless it's through donations, charitable giving. And so we're asking that, and we know you just went through a big fight last year on education tax credit, but we'll continue to ask for this until you have that conversation again. We'd like to see it restored for at least the first $300,000 dollar for dollar tax credit, and that allows us to really give directly to the schools that are in our villages. And and this does happen. Sitnasauk, who asked for this, is giving about $500,000 to their school district every year. And then we want to ensure local content in any statewide infrastructure or capital projects. And I have a feeling we won't be talking about that one this year either, but we'll be focused on that one in the future. Chinan Guninho, thank you for being here. Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting us. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that's the end of my presentation.
Are there any questions from the committee? Sure. Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Thank you for that excellent presentation. Question about the 7i sharing. So the regional corporations, sounds like they're 70% from any one corporation of subsurface estate revenue gets pushed out to the other regional corporations, right? And then did you also say that the village corporations, that was a pass-through from the regional, right? But they're part of that 7i.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Kopp, that's correct. About 50, not about, under the 7i revenue sharing agreement, 70% of the revenues will go to be split amongst the 12 regional in-state corporations, and 50% of that number goes out to that region's villages, and it's called 7J payments.
Okay, 7J. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the Donlin project. So is that on Doyon land?
No, sir, it's on Chalista land.
Okay. Through the chair. So on Chalista land, and so the villages then on Chalista land would benefit from that project should that go through 7J?
Through the chair, if Donlin goes through, every regional and every village corporation right. would benefit.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Bissett, for making time to be here with us today. I would just, again, like to thank both you and Mr. Malott for coming to provide a clear overview of the complex nature of our entities in the Alaska Native community. We will now hear from Jacqueline Kusine Peta. Ms. Peta previously served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. She is a first Vice President of the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska and a board member of Sealaska Corporation. Ms. Peta, please put your name on record and begin your presentation.
Gunashkish Kusinyo Hatu Asak Suka Adi. I had cut Kagwantan Yeti Yeshitak. My English name is Jacqueline Peta. As stated, my Tlingit name is Kusine. I'm currently here in a variety of hats. I do sit as a board member of Sea Alaska, and I'm the second vice president of Tlingit and Haida Tribes of Alaska. I would like to start by, I've been asked here to talk a little bit about housing today, and I would like to start by saying that $94 million of resources comes to the state of Alaska via the NAHASDA, which is the Native American Housing and Self-Determination Act. NAHASDA was created, passed by Congress in 1996, 1998, it was fully implemented. I was called to Washington, D.C. to implement the Act of NAHASDA. And it was a substantial change from the public housing model. The public housing model had, as you know, has rental and other kinds of assistance programs. The tribes across the country, including Alaska, were aggressively involved in redesigning a housing program that was more of a block grant and where we had the flexibility to design programs, leverage dollars, and to be able to meet the needs of our communities, still having to deal with the low-income requirements that had prescribed across the board. And so with this NAHASDA model, we saw that tribes across the country and Alaska really used it to leverage, which was one of the key elements of that. And from the implementation until 2006, we saw a big uptake in the housing leveraging model, a lot of new construction happening. In 2007 to 2010 was really when housing new construction peaked, and partly that was because in 2009 and 10, if you recall, Congress implemented ARRA, which was an investment and infusion in infrastructure dollars for shovel-ready projects, which housing had a lot of. And I bring that up because when I get to the next slide, after that, in 2010 to today, you see a total change in how housing is being applied. not as much new construction, a lot more renovation, and partly because of, okay, which one did you want me to do, use? Sorry. Did. Oh, you want me to do it on here, sorry. Okay, I just wasn't sure which, I was using the wrong clicker, sorry. So if, and I'm not putting this up here for political reasons, but I'm putting it up here for reality. And reality is that, you know, the president's budget just came out. One of my hats that I wear, I'm the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians in Washington, D.C. And we put forward our analysis. And you can see that the proposed budget has a substantial amount of program cuts that actually will impact housing and housing in Alaska. Because we do receive dollars for housing programs that deal with from environmental protection. We do receive dollars and youth programs that come from USDA, from HUD, from Department of Interior, BIA. A number of those programs really help and support the housing infrastructure and the housing related services. So I wanted to share this slide with you. But if we look a little closer and we look at the Native American programs under the Office of Native American Programs in HUD, just specifically, this is what the proposed budget looks like. And I'll talk a little bit about these programs because this is the dollars that come to Alaska. I mean, these are the national dollars, but as I said, 94 million of those dollars come to Alaska through our regional housing authorities and our tribally designated housing authorities. One of the things that NAHASDA did when we implemented it was we recognized the existing housing structure, which is, if you look at the, once again, the same regional structure of the corporations. There was regional nonprofits that was created, and you look, if you can refer back to Anthony's slide. And then the regional housing authorities were created via a state enactment, but they used the same regional construct for doing that, except for Sitka and Metlakatla. And then in the NAHASDA, implementation of NAHASDA, NAHASDA, the Native American Housing and Self-Determination Act, recognized the sovereignty of tribes, and so they said that they wanted tribes to be able to implement the housing programs where tribes chose to take that option. In Alaska, we had some tribes take that option. Several years later, Senator Stevens, by an amendment, decided to cut that option for Alaska, recognizing there was a lot of tribes and was worried about administrative duplication of resources and the dollars not going to new construction. So under that Native American Housing Block Grant, that's where a tribe or a housing entity can do new construction, they can do rehabilitation, they can do leverage, they can do home ownership, they can do whatever however they choose to design their program. Under the Indian Community Development Block Grant Program, and you'll see that that's proposed to be zeroed out, the Indian Housing Block Grant Program is actually a set-aside that comes out of the mayor's money across the country, the Community Development Block Grant Program. We actually get a 3-5% set-aside out of that, and so that's what's important. The Title VI Loan Guarantee Program was another loan guarantee program to allow tribes to leverage their NAHASDA dollars against future infusions of money, similar to how mayors have done with the Community Development Block Grant Program for larger scale infrastructure programs or planning development in the years out. And then I'll skip down to the HUD-VASH program. The HUD-VASH program is a program that is with the housing authorities in conjunction with Department of Veterans Affairs, are really trying to deal with the homelessness and those veterans of ours that are in a significant need. And of course, you know, Alaska has a high percentage of veterans that meet that category, and that's why that program's important to us. And the Housing Improvement Program, that's a HIP program that's operated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And that program provides for the very, very low income. Just this last year, they added the ability to do some home ownership down payment assistance to as an eligible activity, but as you can see, the money isn't being proposed to be increased. And then, of course, the Rural Development 502 Single Family Direct Loan is a USDA loan program. So this gives you an idea of the programs that the that tribes and regional housing authorities in Alaska use.
Ms. Peta, I just want to ask a clarifying question. You had mentioned regional housing authorities. So the nonprofit tribal regional housing authorities, did you mention that those were established under state statute?
Yes, okay. They were established under state statute. And the state statute also dictated how their boards were created, structured, et cetera. And it was thought that, and that was why when NAHASDA was enacted, we wanted to sustain the efforts of the regional housing authorities, but recognize that tribes could opt to choose to do something different for that window of opportunity that was still open for the tribes in Alaska. In the lower 48, tribes still can choose to be the housing designee.
So in just a follow-up question, earlier this week we heard a presentation on compacting. So tribes would elect to compact with those regional housing authorities for the distribution of those dollars. Is that what I'm understanding?
It's not exactly like that because unless the tribe can have agreements with the housing authorities about what their arrangement is and their decision making, but because the legislation, particularly in Alaska, recognized that the regional housing authorities were a rightful entity, unless the tribe proactively chooses to make other options, then they get to fulfill the role, but they can, yes, compact with the tribe to work directly with them.
Thank you.
Yes. So some of the things that this kind of went over what this really what I said earlier. One of the things that's important to note when you talk about the budget issues is that in 1996, the housing dollars across nationwide was $650 million. You look at it now, it's in proposed, recently it's only been about $750 million. It hasn't really gone a lot in a 20-year period of time. And so if it hasn't kept pace, and if it kept pace, it'd be about a $1 billion. So the Alaska housing authorities are substantially dealing with not only housing dollars that are coming from the federal government that haven't kept pace with inflationary factors, to the rise in construction costs and a substantial rise in infrastructure-related issues. And so those are creating a real strain on the Alaska Housing Associations. In fact, one of the big areas HUD did a study just recently, and they said, what are the three big areas why new construction isn't happening? Why are people spending more money on maintenance rather than on new construction? And one of the big areas, 70% said it was the cost of infrastructure. And we know in Alaska that's a substantial issue. So I wanted to briefly walk through the Alaska Housing Association's legislative priorities, not for advocacy purposes, but to be able to talk about why these programs are important. So one of the things that is, even before NAHASDA, the state, when we used to apply for grants with the federal government, the state would provide a match. And this is what the supplemental housing development grant was. And that match actually helped us compete to get more housing in Alaska. When NAHASDA happened, the match maintained because we knew that even with the federal dollars, there's never enough dollars to be able to develop. And primarily the supplemental housing development grants really helped with some of the additional infrastructure needs. So the important thing to remember is that this grant program, that state-funded grant program, it actually really leverages more than 4-to-1 ratios. In fact, most of the times it's greater than 5-to-1 with the other dollars that come in, whether they come from USDA, HUD, or other places. The other area is the reason why census is so important is the NAHASDA dollars under the new program, because it was a block grant program, there was a development of a formula, and the formula is based totally on census figures. Now, we know in Alaska, with a substantial undercount in Alaska, which is documented, that will affect the way that housing dollars are contributed or contributed to Alaska, and that not only affects just the housing dollars, it also affects transportation dollars and other program dollars that are developed through the census formula. This is really significant, particularly in the rural communities of Alaska. The undercount is really hard. We've been working a lot with Census to address that. They gave the across the nation, they gave an adjustment factor for the undercount in Indian country of 4%. In Alaska, they decided to do the adjustment only for what a definition of rural, but that rural definition was so narrow that it didn't necessarily help and assist all of the communities in Alaska. So that was it's an important piece for how housing is funded in Alaska. The census is critical to that. The other part of that is the weatherization program. When you talk to and did surveys across Alaska, and particularly in Southeast Alaska, where we got some really good data from the communities, the number one thing that Native Alaskans have said, which was weatherization and energy efficiency is the most critical need for them. And so when the weatherization program really helps to deal with energy affordability, dealing with mold issues and other kinds of issues within a unit, which could create health risks. And that's why that's important. And then the Senior Citizen Development Grant Program is another special area needs area, as well as the newly teacher and professional health professionals and public safety professionals housing. In our small communities, our rural communities, it's really hard to be able to have any housing that's open because of the overcrowding that's out there. Being able to designate housing units, particularly for those professionals, so that they will actually come to the small communities and serve in the small communities is really important. I also wanted to be able to say, because you wanted to have some economic impact, the $94 million that comes from the federal government actually generates about $193 million of direct and indirect economic activity through the housing programs that the tribes provide. They employ about 1,400 individuals. They construct 125 affordable energy efficient homes. In fact, I want to mention that on the energy efficiency, when the state was really looking at how do we deal with those energy efficient homes, the partnership between the Alaska Construction Associations and the housing authorities really became a testing ground for piloting a lot of those improvements on energy efficiency. And the housing authorities adopted them readily. And of course, the weatherization of 500 homes and the renovation of 500 homes. Those are important statistics. I also gave to you a couple other documents. One was a series of just some background information from the Alaska Association of Housing Authority about these priorities, why is it important. And I'm here attending in town the Southeast Alaska Housing Summit. I wanted to give you the data that was presented there. The first part of it is a lot of economic data around Southeast Alaska. The second section of it is housing data in specific. You'll find some interesting facts there. For example, 22% of households are led by, in Native households, are led by single women, compared to non-Native, where it would be 8% of women households. Significant difference, partly looking at the support system that Native women probably need to have being in their own community. Non-Native single women, perhaps may go to communities where they generated from, where they have greater support systems. You'll look in here, one of the other interesting facts that's when you talk to businesses and they look at some of the barriers for doing business, particularly in Southeast Alaska, because that's where the data was come from, that 62% of the employers said housing was a barrier for them investing or expanding or doing business in our communities. So I wanted to share that with you. I thought it would be interesting information. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you for that incredible recap. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Edgman.
Yes, thank you for the presentation and welcome back home.
Thank you.
So a lot of our villages have substandard housing, mm-hmm. Older housing units, some have newer housing units. We've got great innovation taking place with the Cold Climate Research Center. I'll give Jack Hebert and his program a shout out. But to the issue of weatherization, you know, a lot of my communities have a mix of, you know, I'm thinking of like maybe Togiak or Manicotic or some of these villages that are growing. So you got a mix of HUD houses, some homes that may be newer, a little bit more energy efficient, maybe five-star, perhaps even six-star rated. But you have a lot of older, dilapidated housing units where you've got overcrowded circumstances. So I couldn't agree with you more about weatherization. That's just such a tremendous program. Unfortunately, we don't have the funds going to it, both federally and state driven, that we should have for it. And you know, not only does it provide for sometimes like a 40% increase in efficiency, if you go in and you tape up all the windows, you put in new doors, right, you maybe take a 2x4 structure and you sheathing on the outside or whatever it might be, new mm-hmm. furnace or what have you, but also creates jobs because a lot of the local housing authorities and entities employ local people to go do work that in the case of Bristol Bay or the Lucians, where you have people fish in the summer and then they've got work in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So it's just a sort of a double dip in terms of benefits. But just wanted to maybe give you a quick second. I know time is running short here and I've got to leave as well. But maybe just to talk a little bit more about that, given the sense that, you know, the presentations before you from the regional corporations and the village corporations, you know, indicate that there's a lot of good things going on, a lot of opportunities, but nonetheless, a lot of our villages still are highly impoverished and they don't have good living conditions, and housing really for many is right at the top of the list.
It absolutely is. In fact, when I sit on the tribal council, the number one issue that comes to us all the time is the housing issues, and related to the issues that you're talking about, people that are cold in the winter, don't have the kind of energy efficient units that they need, and the rehabilitation. If you look at even the construction, new construction needs, because it's just the overcrowding itself in Alaska, we would have to have 2,066 units per year, additional units per year. And if you look at, we've only constructed 125 affordable, highly energy homes, that's a lot more to be able to deal with the issue. So you can see the gap is really wide. And weatherization can only do so much to a unit. And so some of the units actually need to be replaced. But because we can't even deal with the other needs of the overcrowding, that becomes a big issue for us.
In follow-up to Vice Chair Edgman's question, what are some of the challenges in bringing new construction to a lot of the communities that are served by the regional housing authorities, just from your experience in the field?
My experience is planning. Planning, first thing is planning. Most grants don't have planning-only dollars, and even planning wasn't an eligible activity under NAHASDA initially. And so it had to be related to a project. And without planning, you can't do the long-term strategy that's necessary for infrastructure development. You have to have so many sources, 10 to 15 sources of funds to be able to get a construction project going. You need to be able to deal with BIA roads. You need to be able to deal with Department of Transportation. You need to deal with IHS to deal with water and sewer, and then to deal with the local city or municipality. Most of those small villages are dealing with problems with water and sewer moratoriums because they've maxed out their levels. They can't add to them. You have to deal with energy issues, trying to come up with affordable energy issues. And just think about, you know, electrification and telecommunication, those kinds of things. Those take longer term planning. And when you have a HUD cycle that's looking at how quickly you pay out your money and spend it out, that planning becomes a gap that doesn't get funded initially so that you can actually get that money out of the pipeline and spent as quickly as you can, or you actually have identified the land and the resources so that you can put the housing on. So that's why many times housing authorities have to do large-scale projects rather than being able to have smaller projects where there's more sustainability, longer-term employment, for example. You can actually groom plumbers and you know, other skilled labor force if you knew that you were going to have 10 units every year in a smaller community rather than doing a large scale once and have to bring in the labor force and then they leave the community. So those are just some examples.
Thank you so much. Are there any other questions from the committee? All right. Guyana, Ms. Peta, and thank you for your many years of service to Alaska. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Next Tuesday, March 19th at 8 a.m., we will be hearing presentations on rural public safety. The time is 9:21 a.m., and this hearing of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs is now adjourned.